Hi everyone, it's Kirsten Gunness here, founder of Professional Women's Lunches, a global networking community for professional women. In today's podcast, I'm talking to Michelle Locke, who is a leadership and communications expert in the neuroscience of human motivation, powerful conversations, and self-leadership. Neuroleadership is a cutting-edge field of study which takes the latest in social cognitive neuroscience and applies it in a practical way to the art of leadership. Michelle's passionate about making leadership easier, believing that if we can understand how the human brain really works and how humans tick, then we have the tools to effectively diagnose and deal with just about any people challenges that present themselves. Michelle's a speaker, author of two books, Your Brain is Your Business, and 52 Weeks of Awesome Leadership. And she's also got an upcoming book, Rewiring Your Conversations. She also mentors and coaches people to perform at an optimal level. Hi, Michelle. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome.
No problems. Good. So let me put you on the spot here. And I'd really like you to tell us a little bit more about who you are.
Ooh, who am I? It's such a big question, isn't it?
I know.
well, I guess on a technical front, I guess I'm an expert in this area of communication and leadership, or neuroleadership in particular is my passion. I live up in Brisbane. I've got a husband and two beautiful children, loving life and loving what I do.
Fantastic. So you initially trained as a teacher. So, and now you're, sort of doing all this fantastic stuff around neuroscience and leaderships. And what actually got you interested in neuroscience in the beginning?
Yeah, look, it's such a great question. And, teaching was such a long time ago. I actually started out as a ballerina and a ballet dancer.
Wow, I
had a ballet school. And then I went into teaching and taught dance, but I also taught commerce. Ah. And, in fact, way back then I wrote a couple of textbooks around business communication and it was just when computers were coming on the scene.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I'm still getting royalties, actually, from those books, which is quite funny, about $5 a year or something. Which is a bit sad. But look, I then went into the corporate world and I decided to do, when coaching was really starting to take on a bit of momentum. And I happened to do my coach training with David Rock, who's now Dr. David Rock,
yep.
who went on to become the founder of the Neuroleadership Institute.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually my trainer at the time, and then I ended up working for what was then Results Coaching Systems.
Yep.
And, of course, that system is neuroscience-based, and
okay.
That's kind of where it got started. I think the deeper interest was when I did start to actually use it and start to train in it and saw the transformation in people in terms of, I guess, giving them just such a deeper understanding about who they are and, in particular, how they lead. And my particular passion in how they have conversations and how we communicate with each other. So, I love it. I think it gives a wonderful foundation for everything that I do and teach.
Because it's interesting, conversation specifically, and I know we're going to go more into how you work with conversations.
Mm-hmm.
Conversations, they're not all what we actually say. It's all of the elements that go with it. It's not just that verbal exactly the wording, it's the pitch, it's all of those other things that aren't necessarily tangible sometimes.
Well, absolutely. And I think I read something the other day where, the communication process, only about 30% of the words are part of that, and the rest is made up with sort of non-verbals and assumptions and all sorts of things that are going on. So, yes, words don't really matter that much, but at the same time, the wrong words can make an enormous difference.
Yeah, and I remember from my time as being a people manager, I had done some training, especially around how we delivered, constructive feedback. And one of the things I was taught very early on was for every piece of constructive feedback, I also needed to give 7 pieces of positive feedback, which is, that's quite a distinct difference between the two. And that was just because of how much damage potentially that constructive feedback could make on people.
Absolutely. And some of the more research recently around that, if you sort of lay that over to emotional experiences, is that we need to experience a ratio of 3-to-1 positive emotions and experience to negative in a day to be a fully functional human being.
Wow.
And when you think of how many negative emotions you can potentially, particularly as women, experience before you even walk into the workplace. You know, you get up, you miss the alarm didn't go off, and then the kids' stuff isn't ready, and, you know, it's yell, yell, get out the door. And you walk into work and you're pretty much behind in your ratio at that point.
Yeah, already. So.
Yeah, that's right. But they say in marriages it needs to be 5-to-1.
Really? Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
So that's an interesting one to think about. And at the other end, once you get to 11-to-1, it almost starts to become counterproductive. It's almost too happy, too perfect.
They're those people that you see walk into the office in the morning, they're all smiley, happy, and you just think,
I hate you.
Yeah. Because, like, I've missed my train, I've spilled coffee on myself, I've just, I know I've got that meeting up front, and I'm just thinking, grouchy, Miss Grouchy, you know.
Yeah. But I guess, you know, this is at the centre of this neuroscience approach to communication and to leadership, and it's understanding these very simple concepts that make us think twice about where we put our attention and what we put our energy into.
I think it's also really important if we're mums looking after children and making sure that we balance out those types of things. We recognise that we're putting the boundaries in there in place because we love our kids. And we also are coming at it from that, I love you, so therefore, you know, I need to put some boundaries in place and manage, you know, what's going on here.
Absolutely. And you know, you just start to tune into different things.
Well, I think with more education, we can sort of learn a few more things from that perspective. When we look specifically at the neuroscience and the you know, the information that's coming out, because I think I've read somewhere that, and especially on your website, that we're actually learning so much more about the brain and how we as humans act. And it's happening in such a fast pace. How are leaders benefiting from this, and what can they do with the information as it comes forward?
Yeah, look, I mean, for those who are starting to immerse in it, I often I talk about the concept of, you know, I sort of go and I ask, so what colour do you wear in your wardrobe? You know, as a corporate, you know, what do we tend to have a predominance of in our wardrobe? And it's black. And why is black? Well, it's black because, you know, it makes us, well, for women, we think it makes us look thinner. you know, it goes everywhere. It's the basic, it's the foundation, and it works, and it can go on for years and years. For me, neuroscience is the new black.
Yeah, okay.
It's a bit like this idea that if you're not now taking advantage of this new information, you are at a disadvantage, and I think your people are at a disadvantage. So, you know, how I think leaders are using it is they're starting to look at the person in front of them as a human being, and they're starting to understand why people do what they do. And that includes themselves. So I talk about, you know, what we're trying to do here is to help leaders to diagnose the human behaviour in front of them so that they have the confidence and the skill to prescribe a different approach to a situation. So it's a bit of the, you know, definition of insanity. Keep doing the things you're doing and you'll keep getting what you've always got. And, you know.
I love that saying.
I know. I think I got it a bit wrong there, but I think you know what I mean. And it gives us the opportunity now to – there's real confidence in going – and having a language for what you're seeing. You're seeing this behavior in this individual and you're going, what's going on there? You know? And then, of course, we make assumptions about that. When we can stop and say, oh, I think it might be this. And we have a language that it does a couple of things. Once, in one sense, it gives us a new line of questioning. So it's a big part of what I teach in my conversations work, which is, if I can diagnose, and we bring it down to five things, we try and make it simple. We have a framework of five potential, what we call threat responses.
Yeah.
Because people, when they respond to something and they display behavior that we perhaps didn't expect, we can sort of categorize it into one of these five domains. Once we think we know what it is, because we can't ever actually know, we can then start a new line of questioning. And that questioning does two things. One, we can clarify whether that is the issue.
Yeah.
Then we can open up a whole new level of understanding on how to deal with it and how to help that person deal with it.
Yeah, and anybody, and you know, I think it comes back to that reptilian brain, you know, sort of thought process where we're, you know, when somebody's trying to delve further in, we do go into that initial, you know, fight, flight, or freeze response. You know, it's the first thing that we all do because we think, oh, you know, somebody's looking at me, they're talking about me, oh, and now I'm potentially, you know, what's going on here? Am I? Should I be concerned about this? You know, not that any of us are paranoid at all.
No, like totally.
Yeah, we're all paranoid for good reason, slightly.
You know, and for good reason. I mean, that part of our brain is there to keep us alive.
Yes.
And but what's interesting, and I think, you know, this is the subtlety of what we're talking about, which is that the definition of a threat in the brain is anything that we didn't expect. And if you think of the number of times in this crazy world now that we have to deal with something, you know, that we didn't expect, it's virtually makes up 80% of our day. Yeah. So the capacity and the understanding of this first, but then the capacity for us to override our natural response, which we're quite capable of doing, although it is energy intensive to do that.
Yeah.
I think that's the skill of the new millennia. I think that's what it's all about. So I talk about the SAS soldier.
Yes.
Our brain is wired to do three things, to survive, to adapt, and to be social. You know, that's what drives our species. And, you know, inside our head is this intelligent brain, this prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain. And it has the capacity to override our natural responses. So to me, it's like an SAS soldier, a normal soldier, does what it's, you know, does what they're told to do. But the SAS soldier has to sometimes look at a circumstance and say, my training's not going to work here. Usual thing isn't going to work. I have to do something different. That's all of our prefrontal cortex in our brain. And so, again, this forms the foundational information about how we have conversations in a very different way and what we have to be taking care of, you know.
It's almost that whole concept of, you know, the information comes at us, let's take a very big, deep breath, let it out, and then deal with it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Which many of us don't, because we just go reaction. I have to admit that's usually my first call is to just react.
Yeah. Well, if it helps to make it feel a little better, we actually can't stop reaction.
Yeah, okay.
So, we do react. It's a natural, you know, thing for us to do, and it's the right thing for us to do. It's how quickly and how effectively we can stop and intervene. So we have 0.05 of a second, which in neurological terms is actually quite a long time, between when we react and when we then make a choice to respond, if that makes sense.
Wow.
Now, there are two roads we talk about in the brain, the high road and the low road. And the low road goes straight from reaction to a reactive response, if that makes sense, which is I see the towel on the floor in the bathroom, I yell at the kids without thinking about it, you know.
Or the husband's left their socks on the lounge, in my case.
Exactly. So, or we can train ourselves to get better at being more mindful of that reaction, and then we take what we call the high road. It's slightly slower, again, in neurological terms, but it's the thing that actually brings in the intelligent brain that says, let me just check out whether my reaction was just survival or whether, in fact, it's a misinterpretation of the potential danger. And therefore, it also allows us to think about consequences. So the reaction is, I want to punch that guy in the face. And then the low road is I punch them.
Yes.
And, of course, you know,
consequences.
Yeah, intoxicated or highly emotional, that thinking brain doesn't have the chance to jump in. So that's where you know, managing emotion is very important. Being able to, in that split second, think through the consequences of if I hit him, maybe the outcome won't be good for me.
Yeah, especially in a workplace that won't be.
Workplace, that's right. So probably again, any. Understanding, you know, when we take the low road and the high road. I think the other thing that's really important is that sometimes we can't help but take the low road. Sometimes, you know, we're tired and that brain that does jump in is it's an energy intensive process for the brain because it's such a new part of the brain. And, you know, our brain runs on this fuel of glucose and oxygen, but it runs out.
Yeah.
So, you know, we use it up, and by the end of the day, we've just got less capacity to, you know, bring the SAS soldier in. Mm. So I think the other thing that I am very sort of verbal about when I'm teaching this stuff is that if you do get it wrong, the first thing you have to do is make it right.
Yeah. Mm.
It's the thing that says I'm very, you know, I find it very easy now to sort of go, you know what I just said was completely wrong and inappropriate.
Mm.
You know what? I just lost it then and I shouldn't have and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Mm. And I do that now a lot with my kids.
Yeah.
Whereas I think we tend to be avoiders and pusher under the carpeters.
Yeah.
I think that's not good for us.
I think the whole thing of it's really funny. I used to work with a girl and she actually had a physical reaction if she ever had to say the word sorry. I actually think the word couldn't come out of her mouth. Not that that was a bad thing for her. And it's really funny when we say this because women are great at apologising. Actually, we probably apologise way more than we probably should. So it's probably more about removing the word sorry or apology from our vocabulary and finding another way to do it. We can sort of manage the situation but not use those particular words all the time.
Well, I think the problem is, and I know you and I talked a little bit about sort of male-female differences, not that that's where we're focusing today, but, you know, it can be seen as weak.
Yes.
And it's not. In fact, I think it's very strong and very courageous. But you're right. Giving people and women in particular the right words. So, you know, my response was inappropriate then. Mm-hmm. I'd like to kind of redo that.
Yes.
Or you know what? You know, my emotional response took over because da-da-da-da-da. Mm. It's those sorts of things because, and I think we can be very powerful.
Yeah, and words do have power. Like I've removed the word just because it actually removes my power in particular situations. And yes. I had to mentally work on that. Every time I wrote the word in an email, I sort of had said to myself, okay, here's a word. I'm not comfortable with using it anymore because it does lower my power threshold in relationships. And I worked on it, and I've worked on it for years. My next thing is all the whole sorry and apologising because I just think sorry, it's one of those words that can appear, you know, very weak at times and removes, you know, some of that power threshold. So
yeah.
It's, you know, I think some words do have more power than others.
They do, and remember I said sort of 30% of the communication is words. Sometimes the words are less the issue than the way you say it.
Yeah.
So for us, sorry can be, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know what, that was inappropriate, I'm really sorry.
It's not as authentic.
That I allowed that to, you know, to get out there.
Mm, it's authenticity behind it sometimes as
well.
Yeah,
yeah, yes, that's absolutely true. And of course, the other thing we delve into a little bit is understanding the neurochemistry behind the reaction of certain words. So Judith Glaser, for example, the conversational intelligence guru, will talk about, she says, words create worlds.
Mm.
And we talk about certain words that are cortisol-producing words and words that are oxytocin or trust-producing words and or phrases or sentences or approaches, you know, those sorts of things. One of the ones I've started to really work on is we went from yes, but, which most of us now know is not really the way to go, although I think we still do that in our personal lives, yes, but, because, of course, then it negates everything.
That I've just said before.
That I've just said. We've gone to yes and, but I think it now has the same connotation as yes but. So I'm moving to yes. I can understand where you're coming from.
Well, that's a nicer way to put it.
Yeah, so four steps. When you think about the power of a great conversation has, in my mind, four steps. And the first one is validation. Whatever that person is saying is right. It's right for them. It's their truth.
Mm.
And I think we don't stop enough to go and validate their thinking.
Mm.
We can then add to that thinking. We can then put an alternative view. But it's the validation. The second step is around then seeking some form of permission. And this is a sort of brain opening thing, but seeking some form of permission to add or contradict or provide, you know, some sort of alternative. So, I can see what your thinking is there. I have some different thoughts. Could I add those?
Mm.
Or would you be interested in hearing an alternative view?
Yeah.
And no one's going to say no.
Because we're all too polite sometimes.
Well, you know, but it's just that thing that's actually saying, I'm respectful enough of you, which is an oxytocin-producing interaction.
Yeah.
I'm respectful enough of you to at least say, are you even interested in hearing my view? You know? And it's amazing how that can turn a situation around. The third step then is about curiosity.
Mm.
So once you've kind of got that and you've got the permission to continue, stop and get curious. Find out more about their point of view. Find out more about what they're thinking or what's driving it. And so much can be unleashed in that third step that completely changes the way you all think.
Yeah.
Mm. And the fourth is that, and what I say to my students is that only after you've done the first three are you allowed to then challenge or move forward or clarify. So it's validation, permission, curiosity, and only then can you bring in your stuff.
Mm.
And that becomes really respectful. It becomes, and it's a great strategy for children.
Mm. Yeah, I could just imagine that because, I mean, you know, their whole learning process is just, it's almost like they're just sucking things in by osmosis and there's no right, wrong or experience associated with that data. And we're very much the product of our upbringing, you know, and that's what puts us usually on the path of the self-awareness journey.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, as parents, we think we know best and we don't have a lot of time.
Mm.
And so we jump into, but this is what you need to do.
Mm. Mm.
And it's not helping them. It's not helping them become good thinkers. It's not helping them take responsibility for their own thinking, you know. And so, look, at the end of the day, my definition of a powerful conversation is one where all parties involved leave the conversation with different thinking than when they came.
Mm.
So I'll say that again, where all parties leave the conversation with different thinking than when they came. It means that we're all open to acknowledging that we don't have all the answers.
Yeah.
We're open to acknowledging that someone else may have something to contribute. And, you know, particularly in a leadership perspective, and when you're looking and saying, what is that behavior about? If you've been able to validate, get curious, you know, and seek permission and be really respectful, it's amazing what someone will share with you. And then you can go, now I get it. And sometimes the intervention that you need to make as a leader is so minor. Whereas you thought you had to go solve some sort of big problem.
Yeah, and usually it's not because they've already got the answer, funnily enough.
Of course.
Yeah. Doing the research for this podcast, I was reading your white paper around rewired conversations, and it was stating there that up to 95% of our verbal exchanges in a workplace were what we call telling conversations. So that's, you know, we just stand there and we actually just tell somebody either what we want them to do, what we want them to think, or how we want them to behave. That's actually quite a high number. So how do we, you know, obviously, you know, you've just gone through that four-step process. Are there other things that we need to do to move away from telling people and to get at that more engaging and transformation conversation, or do we just work through that four-step process?
Well, the four-step process kind of sits within a conversation. When we look at this, so there's a couple of things here first. First is really working to shift, and you've already said it, that basic assumption that people have the answers they need.
Mm.
What we do know is when we tell, the brain resists.
No.
Because at the end of the day, the you know, telling is saying, I'm better than you. And so we have this whole status thing going on, you know, inside our brains. And the status, a threat to our sense of status is, you know, shuts down the brain and you know, takes us into that survival mode.
Mm.
So shifting the, first of all, just shifting the concept and going, you know, you have the answer that you need. Mostly, if you think about it, the number of people who come to you, they ask you a question and all they're wanting to do is find out if your response was the same as what they were thinking.
Right.
You know? So the first thing is making that shift. The second, every time you solve somebody's problem for them or tell them what they need to do, firstly, you're doing all the work. So you're using up your, you know, 3 hours of prefrontal cortex time. Yeah.
Yes.
So that's not productive.
No.
Secondly, you're very squarely taking the monkey off their back and putting it on yours and doing the job for them. Mm. You're not teaching them to think. You're teaching them to be lazy.
You know, it's that whole fish adage, you know, teach them to fish and, you know, they'll always be able to eat, which I just love.
Well, it's so true. And we have this misconception that if we stop and have a different sort of conversation that gets them talking and thinking, that it takes more time. Mm. And it's actually quite the opposite. It takes less energy. You walk away with nothing to do from the conversation, whereas I guarantee that, you know, most of the leaders I work with spend their whole days taking everyone else's job on, you know, and then everyone else just goes, oh, that was cool. that works for me.
Yeah.
You know, you're often not getting the best outcome because you haven't stopped.
Mm.
You haven't given them that sense of empowerment.
Mm.
And you haven't got curious and found out because you've jumped into some kind of assumption around what they need. I'm sure you've also experienced where you go in to get some help from someone and then they rabbit on for 20 minutes and they tell you everything you already knew.
Yes.
And you think, oh, I'm over this now, I'm tired, I'll get out of here, and I didn't learn anything new anyway. Whereas if that person is really skilled, and this is where I'm really passionate, is to develop in leaders, in women, the capacity to have really master these conversations, really, you know, become a master at them, because that's what gives you the confidence and the courage to have the conversations, and it also allows you to get those monkeys off your back.
Yeah. Mm.
And if you can get somebody... if I can sort of share a story, when I first started learning this stuff, and I decided I was working at PricewaterhouseCoopers at the time, and I had quite a big team, and I had a young gentleman in there who would come often wanting me to, you know, tell him what to do, solve problems, so on and forth.
Mm.
So I started using my new coaching skills.
Yes.
And so I would say, okay, so, and I'll call him John. So, John, thinking, have you done so far around this issue? And he'd go,
this wasn't the response I thought I'd get.
Yeah, I was expecting you to just tell me what to do, which is what I used to always do, of course.
Yes,
just
because
I was important and I was the boss and, you know, so on and so forth. And I'd say, okay, so, you know, what do you, you know, and all that stuff about what do you think we should do. Mm. What essentially happened over time is that he would then come to me and he would say, so this is the thinking I've done about it so far. Mm. This is the research I've done. I've spoken to X, Y, and Z, and I'm thinking this is the way we should take it forward.
Mm.
All I then had to do was be, you know, the checker.
Yes.
I just had to go, yep, tick that box, or I might ask a few questions that were just to test a few things. And every time we did that, of course, he got better at dealing with the issue, thinking through the issue and coming with a more well-thought-out response. And the pride that he took in that, because one of the things you have to realise is that when we solve a problem or we have that sort of aha moment, we get a sort of a dopamine hit, you know, a pleasure hit in our brain. So when you as the boss or you as the parent solve the problem for someone else, it's like you're being quite nasty. you're stealing their pleasure hit.
Ooh.
It's like, how dare you?
You've taken away my chocolate.
Give me back my dopamine hit, yes. You know? And, of course, this really contributes into what we were talking about earlier in terms of those positive emotional experiences. So the 3-to-1 ratio, you know?
Yeah.
So if you can actually stop and have the skill to have the conversations that allow people to solve their own problems or remove their own barriers or do their own thinking, then you're really, really contributing to their capacity to A, grow and develop, and B, be a much happier human being. And you know, you sort of can't deny that is a good thing to be doing.
No. And it's interesting because in one section of your Rewired Conversation white paper, there was the use of the word influencer, which for many of us, we look at that from more of a marketing perspective. You know, it's that person who is really affecting the decision we make around some sort of purchasing. However, you really see the influencer as the person who is helping unleash significant potential, and I think the statistics were around 80 to 100% of the potential of that individual.
Yes. If you think about it, we spend 80% of our day, or leaders, you know, in particular, spend 80% of their day in conversation. So it's an enormous leverage point for us. It's an enormous opportunity to be supporting and influencing the people around us to behave differently if need be, and to, you know, be creative and solve problems. Yeah. So I'm sure you've heard of the term neuroplasticity.
Yes.
And the thing about neuroplasticity is it's now become a bit sort of pop culture-ish, which is fine. But I think, you know, when we can sit down and show people the real power of what it is, at the end of the day, what it means is that our brains are plastic, and that they are constantly changing and rewiring in response to our environment. Mm. Now, that happens anyway. It happens randomly. So I like to talk about the idea of deliberate neuroplasticity.
Okay.
This is about taking control of your own brain and how it's growing and developing. Mm. And it all happens through the concept of attention. So where we focus our attention is where the brain puts its energy and then grows.
Mm.
So as you know, and you're learning to drive, at first it's all a bit awkward.
Yes.
But the more we do it, the more we put the focus and attention on a particular series of thinking actions or behavioural actions, they become encoded and hardwired into our brain.
Mm.
And that's all about the attention we give, you know.
Yeah.
And we don't really lose that. We can't unwire the brain. We can rewire, and we can create new wiring and make it stronger. So the challenge, of course, is that, you know, sometimes we put attention on the wrong things.
Yes.
And we wire in non-useful behaviours, non-useful thinking, non-useful concepts.
Mm.
And it's very basic. If I were to hold up a shirt that you've been told all of your life that thing is associated with a word called shirt, and I tried to tell you it was a shoe, and that all your life, you know, you've been paying attention to the wrong word, you'd be going, you're an idiot. You know?
Yeah, I'd struggle with that one, Michelle.
Well, that's right. But that is very basic. That's what it's about, is that whatever we've created and the belief that we've encoded into our brain is our truth, you know? And so the thing here, though, for leaders, and I think also for parents, and I'm very passionate about the idea of, you know, bringing this power of conversation and this skill, of this mastery skill, to parents and to women and to leaders, is that what it means is that you as a leader or a parent have a lot more influence over the wiring of the brains of the people around you than we ever thought.
Mm.
And it's simply about noticing where they're focusing their attention and either reinforcing that if it's useful for the goals that we're looking for, or redirecting their attention if it's not useful. For example, you don't say to a child, don't fall out of the tree.
Well, no.
Because they go, oh, we can fall.
Right.
I haven't considered that possibility until right now. Oh, now
right.
I'm scared and I lose my grip. We say, hold on tight.
Hmm.
Now, what is it that you want to make stronger in their thinking, in their brain, and put your attention there? But, of course, what we do as leaders is someone comes in and says, can I talk this issue through? And you say, sure, what's the problem? And then we spend 45 minutes unpacking the problem so that the leader thinks, so I can get all the information to solve the problem. So firstly, I don't need to solve the problem. You can solve the problem. Let me be the expert in the process and you be the expert in the content.
So it's almost changing the conversation, or, you know, and I'm meaning a concept, is to say, well, let's actually, instead of being the problem solver for everybody, it's actually being an expert in how to explore a conversation better.
Absolutely. And it's funny you should say better, because
see, I've done my research.
Yes, one of the key models, it sounds like we planned that.
I know.
One of the key models that I work with is I talk about the six key shifts that we have to make to have these much more powerful conversations. And they spell out the word better, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So the better is brain friendly. We've got to really understand that the brain will respond and think much better if we make a shift from telling to ask.
Mm.
tell to us. The second is that the E is around managing emotions. So we know that when we're in that threat state, when we are, you know, when our limbic brain is firing, the logic brain, the intelligent brain can't function.
Mm.
Because our primitive brain will always win. It's the one that's about survival. And so, you know, if we're going to continue the species, we need to be paying attention to our brain. But, of course, most of our threats these days are social threats rather than physical threats.
Yeah, that's right.
The first T then is about being toward focus. And this is very much where we explore the neuroplasticity stuff. Mm. If we can focus on what's useful and the future and where we need to go and what we've got to create, much more powerful than focusing on the past. And the problem with focusing on the past, of course, is firstly, we can't change it.
No.
But secondly, we waste an awful lot of time. But thirdly, in this really crazy world, it's also confusing. There is such a multiplicity of circumstances that lead to the problems that we face that almost unpacking the past becomes irrelevant.
Mm.
We certainly have to understand it, but the amount of time that we should spend doing that should be much more limited and much more focused in a series of targeted questions rather than dwelling on it.
Yeah.
We know that if we're into sort of drama and venting and blaming, we're in the wrong space. We're not in a useful space.
No, it's not going to help anybody really at the end of the day. Not at all.
Yeah, it feels good because it feels like we're doing something, but it doesn't actually help. You're right. Mm. The second T then is testing assumptions. So we are designed and wired to make assumptions, but again, they don't serve us. We need to get curious, and that's part of my sort of the model and being focused on, and also understanding what curious looks like. So it's all very well to say in all of these things, yes, we've got to get curious, but most people will say, well, I know that. But I don't know how. I don't know what the questions are to ask. So this is what we can teach. Mm. The E is about encouraging the right wiring, and we want to move from this sort of fixed to growth mindset, the idea that we can grow and become someone new and different. And the R is about clear responsibility. So in those situations we were just talking about, whose responsibility is it to do the thinking?
Mm.
Me as the boss, or is it you as the person I'm paying, quite frankly, to do the teaching?
Yeah.
So the shift we want to make there is from being the consultant or the problem solver to the facilitator of great thinking.
Great thinking, yeah. And that probably brings me into the question about, do we think or believe that neuroleadership is something that all of us should be focusing on, or is it just for those in leadership or managerial roles?
Well, I can give you my personal view.
I would love your personal view.
Which, of course, is absolutely. I just think this is about better humans. My tagline of my business is, so the business is called Leading Humans, and the tagline in a way is, to lead humans, you need to be a leading human.
Mm.
And I think self-leadership is at the core of all of this.
Yes.
And if we can all be better self-leaders, if we can be better humans, then I think, you know,
the whole process is a lot easier to work through.
Well, it is, and I think we can enjoy life a lot better. It'll be easier for us to let go of stuff, easier to move on. And look, we're never going to get it right. We are human. Mm. But I think it's also embracing that.
Yes.
So I do talk about, you know, the difference between I think we've become amateur humans. And I think we need to start professionalizing. We need to become professional humans, and I think that's a really great endeavor.
It's a really interesting concept.
Yeah, well, and it's not that we've become amateur humans, but that we now are learning so much, where we're looking at the way we've been interacting with each other and the way we've been role modeled, and saying, gee, the science is telling me that some of the things that we do naturally or that we do habitually are good, but some aren't.
Mm.
And, you know, perhaps we got it wrong.
And that's a really good segue then to my next question, which is around, we've had such a makeup of the business and society, and it's, in some respects, it's been based on a command control structure. And I'm really passionate about this whole concept of, you know, we have a boys club and some elements are not great, but other elements are really, really good. And more women should be jumping in and actually taking some of those skill sets and capabilities. And we should be building a very similar framework. And we know that there's this whole heap of pre-established rules on how business is done and the roles that we're born into. I think we've seen a lessening of this. And do you see that there's a further change in rules and the structure? And what do you think is really causing this?
So that's a very big question.
No, all good.
Look, I think, absolutely. I think it's changing. I think we are seeing that. A lot of the work in this neuroleadership space is being done around bias and diversity, cognitive bias, and really understanding what drives that. I think the nice thing about neuroleadership is that it allows me, as I learn more, to be less angry and less critical about the situation we have, because I can understand how it came about.
Yes.
And I can understand the protection needs of the people who've created these structures. So they're keeping these structures because it's a sense of status for them, it's a sense of certainty for them, it gives them control. And those things are all, on a continuum in our brain from threat to reward. So we seek reward and we avoid losing those things. So there's a, at the very heart of human motivation is the thing that creates these things that don't work for us. So again, it's the SAS soldier. It's our capacity, firstly, to create an awareness so that we can understand and diagnose what's going on, which then allows us to move forward. And no intelligent person in their right mind, when they start to really think about it, can't not shift their thinking. So one of the main programs I run is a four-day program, and we do it over a month. It's a day, a break, 2 days, a break, and a fourth day. On the first day, we focus on human motivation and understanding what really goes inside the brain. And, you know, there are differences in gender, but there's also not that much difference. And I think it's just an understanding, of the value of everything that it brings. And of course, the big one is always emotion. You know, men talk about, and look, let's face it, men are emotional, but they just, for some reason, want to deny it.
Well, they just do it a little bit differently sometimes too.
They do, and they hide it differently. And, of course, there's the role modelling and that sort of, stereotyping and stuff. And we've got to break all of that down. And, of course, it's all about having different conversations. So instead of accepting it, the power of being able to ask really, really thoughtful questions and make people think. Because the minute we try and say yes, but, up go the protection mechanisms, and there's no thinking going on. When we go yes, and we validate and say, yes, I see where you're coming from, I get that. Tell me a bit more about that. Let me get really curious and understand your perspective. Look, it'd be all right if I share my experience, though. And going down that track, it's very simple. And there are three critical areas of focus for me as we work. And look, it's great to work in organisations and leaders because, of course, these people are influencers and people do look up to them. So I think that's a great target group. And the other one is parents. I think I would love to work with parents and women. I think we can make a big difference there as well. But there are three critical areas. And the one is we need to become masters of human motivation. So we have to start to really understand what are these human skills. This is the professionalizing of being a human. So I think that's the first piece, putting a science behind it. The second piece is mastery of self. Again, we're now learning more and more about what makes us tick and how things work. And so really developing that capacity for empathy, resilience, being a, and that will it enables us to maintain that optimal functioning. We know that the capacity for the for calm, you know, that person who has the capacity for calm is the person with the most resources at their disposal in that moment.
Which I can actually say at times during my career I was not very calm, and it's something that I'm still having to work on because I probably went reptilian first and then freaked out and then did all the things I wasn't supposed to do. But at least I – my big thing is I recognise, and I think that's the first part of the process to move forward.
It absolutely is. And over time you recognise it more and more in the moment and can deal with it there and then, you know. And sometimes dealing with it means shutting the whole thing down and saying, you know what, now is not the time to be having any of these conversations. Let's all go to get a coffee.
Yeah. you know, way too emotional.
Yeah, that's right. So mastery of human skills, mastery of self, and then sort of sitting underneath that, of course, is the mastery of conversation. Really being able to then take those two things and have a skill and a structure and a framework and a mastery of how we then interact with other people. And when you bring those three things together, you know, that's when I think we're starting to really rewire who we are as humans and setting ourselves up for, you know, this increasingly accelerating, changing VUCA world that we find ourselves in.
And it's really, you know, the world is changing so rapidly. I mean, in some respects, we're still stuck very much in a society that values IQ significantly, but we're starting to see that real shift of some organisations being at the leading edge of wanting their people to not just be IQ but also EQ heavy, because it is all about being a human being, and we actually do, you know, part of our job on an everyday level is dealing with other human beings.
Well, no human beings and no
money.
No organisation. Yeah. I watched a documentary last night on artificial intelligence that was interesting, you know, really exploring some of the big social problems that we're going to have are that for the first time in history, as we move from, you know, we went from the industrial age to the information age, as we move from this sort of age into the artificial intelligence age, I guess, or the experience age, for the first time, many of the jobs that would in the past change and therefore would just require new skills to fill won't be there.
Yeah, and that's scary, I think, for a lot of people.
Well, it is, and some of the implications are quite huge. Elon Musk was talking last night that, you know, one of the economic issues is going to be that there literally won't be things for people to do. So we have to consider a concept, which is that everyone gets a standard salary from the government.
Yeah.
You know? Because otherwise, how are people going to live? How do we stimulate, you know, economically?
Yes.
How do we make it sustainable? So there's some very big questions. But these are questions require thinking.
Yes.
And thinking requires quality conversation and requires us to be open to being, you know, to thinking differently and having those conversations. The Neuro Leadership Institute has done some research around what are the new leadership skills that we're going to need going into the future. So in the past, we've talked about building more sort of processes and structures and philosophies and concepts for leadership, and all that's great.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go underneath, I talk about sort of going, you know, let's look at the leader beneath the leader.
Yes.
You know, what are the skills that we really need there? And so they've come up with four, and I've added two just to make myself feel important.
Love that, Michelle.
And want to do.
Yes,
So first is focus skills, and that's the capacity to cut through distraction. Mm. You know, for a leader to understand there of the million things we could be paying attention to, which ones should we pay attention to?
Yeah.
Because the capacity is huge, and we just can't keep adding stuff the way we do. You know, we physically can't fit it in, and we mentally can't fit it in.
Yeah.
The second is learning skills. So we're understanding more and more about how the brain learns and, you know, how difficult it is for stuff to stick. And so it means we need to change the way we grow and develop people. Mm-hmm. So that's really important. The third one is personal skills. And so that's the self-leadership stuff, the resilience, the empathy, and the capacity to know what you want and how to get it in a way that doesn't offend people. how you carry yourself and interact with others. And I would probably, you know, say that those conversation skills almost sit a little bit in the personal skills. The fourth is social skills, and this is around our capacity to read others.
Haven't we lost those skills?
Yeah, it's a real challenge. It's a real challenge. And, you know, we put on a front, we have a Facebook page, and we have a Facebook face. I've just recently been travelling and watching the amount of effort going into hair and makeup before a selfie. It's just remarkable to watch. And not only that, what really got me was that in many cases, you know, you're in an amazing place. I'm thinking where I was in Santorini in Greece with this incredible view, but they didn't even think to turn around to have the view in the background. It was like, here I am in Santorini and I'm looking fabulous, but there's no pictures of Santorini.
My husband and I are the opposite when we travel. There's no photos of us. So, you know, future generations of our family are going to look back and go, who were those people? Because they're not in any photos. There's no photographic evidence of them existing.
You know, it's amazing. But we are very social creatures, and it's manifesting itself differently with these devices. But in the same way that just, you know, when we first brought cars into the world, lots of people died and, you know, they ran into each other and ran over each other and had accidents.
And everybody poo-pooed and said, no, we'll just keep the horse and the donkey, you know.
Yeah, we didn't throw out the car. We just brought in new ways to manage it. We brought in traffic lights. We brought in rules, you know.
Mm.
And I think devices are the same thing. We have to start understanding, you know, how to manage them better. Mm. And I think that is happening as well. Mm. But, yeah, this capacity to be in the moment and be more focused on the person in front of you and what's happening for them and being able to read it,
mm.
you know, to read somebody's social cues and then and to understand what's truly going on, to get to the truth, is a huge skill that leaders need to develop.
Mm.
And the other thing that I would add then are, of course, conversation skills, because I really believe that if you can change the way people have conversations and that they understand the humanness beneath the person in front of them and they understand, you know, that they have exceptional self-leadership, you can change a culture.
Yes.
Because, you know, change happens one conversation at a time, not in one conversation. And I think a lot of leaders think that we can go out, we can send out the email, we can do the roadshow, show the PowerPoint, and it'll miraculously happen.
And funnily enough, it doesn't, because you have to constantly, you have to, you know, not everybody catches the absolute point each and every time. So you've got to go back and reinforce the messages that we want to get across to people. And we just do it once.
Yeah. And remember, until they get it, until they've had their own aha moment, right? And aha moments don't come from telling.
No.
They come from asking. And that person answering their own, you know, answering the question in a way that makes the connection for them, because, you know, again, because of this neuroplasticity thing, we are so differently wired. I can't predict how it's going to make sense for you.
Mm.
Only you can, but yes, I can facilitate it. You know, what we do know now is we know a lot about how insight occurs in the brain, and we know neurochemically what happens when insight occurs, and it's good.
Mm.
You know, it is that.
Have that dopamine.
Yeah, you almost need to have insight for behavior to change.
Mm.
And so if what we can do is we can artificially set up through our questioning techniques the, you know, the perfect environment for an aha moment. So there's no guarantee it'll happen, but we can certainly significantly increase in the way we have conversations and create this environment for an aha moment, because when they have the aha,
mm.
that's when behavior change and that's when they buy in.
Yeah.
But organisations are running on, you know, leaders will go off and they'll have their junket and they'll spend 6 months coming up with a strategy. They know it intimately. They've tested it. And then they go out and do one big massive communication and a couple of roadshows.
Yeah, and it's not. You
know. So to me that means that, in fact, the focus of these communication skills need to be absolutely at the top, but more so at the powerhouse of middle management.
Yeah.
Because they are the people who've got to have the daily conversations and who've got to have the patience and the self-leadership to have that patience to sit and go, let me just help you think it through.
And it's really hard in organisations, you know, having worked my way up through and have been, you know, I've had the experience of working in middle management. It's so hard. I knew that every day, you know, my day job was to work with my team, respond to queries, deal with, you know, whatever came my way, and my whole, you know, from when my staff got in to the time they left, that was the time I focused on them. But then I had a second job to do.
Mm.
And I, you know, and that's part of the problem. I think we've moved away from people managers being people managers.
Yes.
We give them lots of jobs and we go, here, you know, not only do you help build these people to go on to be, you know, productive and effective and you know, drive revenue in an organisation, but you also give these poor people managers another lot of stuff to do, which just they're dead by the end of each day.
Yeah, and that's where self-management and self-leadership, you know, really plays a part. So the journey that we take people on is we start with that human motivation stuff. So what the journey we're going on is we want to take them from, particularly middle leaders who are, you know, emerging as leaders, from being a technician, because that's where they got what they got, being good at what they're doing, and they really need some investment in this people stuff, to being what I would call a master mentor.
And many organisations just don't either put the time, the effort or the money into transitioning them from being that tech to being a manager.
Yes, and they pay for it, because the time wasted. I was talking to an engineering firm the other day, and I said to the CEO, how much time do you think is wasted on people issues that need to be, you know, resolved, that are ongoing? And he said 20, 25%. And I said, multiply that by your salary bill. And he just about fell off his chair.
Oh, yeah, because you're just wasting and time's money in a commercial world.
Yeah, absolutely. And and you've got to be able to, I guess, put a dollar figure on it. But that's where you get your return on investment, because if you start to develop these master mentors, then they start to mentor people in-house.
Mm.
And you start to get this kind of, you know, contagion effect. Yes. And so we take them through, you know, I like to take leaders on a journey. And this is a journey that can go over a year or 6 months or whatever it happens to be. Mm. We can do it in a day, but you and I know that in a day.
No, nothing.
Nothing. But we start with the human motivation. Understand the human in front of you so that you can diagnose that human behavior and you can prescribe effective responses for each individual.
Yeah.
And what that means is that the leader becomes a master of engagement. Then we move into really focusing on self-leadership. And when people are good self-leaders, they make good decisions.
Mm.
So that flows on to them being masters of performance.
Yes.
Third level, we look at execution. How do we get things done? How do we get the very best from our brain, be it thinking, you know, or whatever it happens to be? How do we last 10 hours a day effectively when, in fact, we only have 3 hours of good thinking time available in our brain? So then they become masters of productivity. The fourth then is the powerful communication. This is where leaders need to be able to enable change but also create buy-in, and they become masters of influence. And then the icing on the cake for me is teaching leaders thought leadership, really getting them to understand how do they inspire themselves and others to do that quality thinking and great work. And that, I believe, is where leaders then start to gain respect of their people.
Mm-hmm.
So we're taking them from being those reactive people, you know, we talked about that earlier,
yes,
to a place of having impact with all of these skills, but then to a place of being that inspiring person. And we all know them in our organisations, those master mentors who are just inspiring people to be around.
Mm.
And we want more of those.
Definitely. I mean, it's so interesting at the moment. If we look at the world, we've got such an intersection at the moment happening, which is really growing, and it's between that whole science element and also the alternative health movement around thinking, around understanding about who we are as human beings. It's just such an exciting time to sort of almost be around, even though there's all of these challenges that are popping up, you know, things like AI, you know, what will our children be doing in 20 years' time? You know, what type of jobs are they? You know, what are the societal impacts? It's just an amazing time to be alive in some respects.
Absolutely. And again, this documentary I watched last night, so they were talking to people about, you know, what the future means. So you have the habitual threat response people who went into, oh, but if there's driverless cars, I like driving my car and you know, what will I do? And all the negative side of things. And then there were people going, wow, what possibilities does that open up for us? You could be giving tax advice while the car's driving you somewhere, while you're driving your client, you know.
Hang on, don't we sort of do that now?
Well, kind of, yeah, but you can concentrate. And they were saying all of these things around, you know, and at the end of the day, 90% of accidents on the road are human error.
Yeah.
So even if you reduce that error by X amount, you're saving lives.
Mm.
But it's about this developing a habitual response in your brain. And you can do this through the neuroplasticity and the attention, which says, here's an issue. And the first thing you look at is what's the opportunity that now provides us with.
Yeah, much more positive.
But most of us will go into vent, blame, fear, drama. And it's just not useful.
The drama llamas
in our life.
The drama llamas.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, I think this is why I use the term, you know, and have embraced the term rewire. If we can rewire our leaders, rewire our conversations, you know, and rewire ourselves and know how to do that, I think we can truly, truly start to set. And if we don't, I think we're in trouble.
Yeah.
We need to set ourselves up for coping with the very world that we've created.
Yeah. Oh, I'm just, thank you so much for your time today, Michelle. I've just written all of these notes and I've got all these things that are going through my brain now. I'm definitely going to be getting that Judith Glaser book. That just fascinates me, that whole thing of which words are producing trust and different chemicals in my brain. That's just the fact that I only do 3 hours of real thinking every day has got me now. Because I quite often like to book time out to do thinking, you know, real mindful thinking.
Yes.
And I have to say, maybe I just didn't realise I only had that little time.
Yeah.
What am I spending it on?
What that sort of provides you with then, and you know, what it really means is that you do a lot of stuff on auto.
Yes.
And you've just got to be a little bit mindful about whether that auto stuff is useful. So sometimes we're doing stuff, but at the end of that, you know, hour or two, you sort of go, well, did I actually achieve something?
Yeah.
You know, so it's the mindfulness around that. The thought of being able to take so much more control over how we live our lives through this lens, you know, and it's just one lens, but it is a lens that I think is really useful. And because it is science, people really connect with it.
Yeah.
They really, you know, and people who are smart people in organisations, they go, I get it. I had one principal who said to me, she did my course and then she brought all of her staff to do the same course because she said, it just made everything I've ever learned make sense.
Yes.
You know, and everything I believed in makes sense. And now I've got a new language to talk to other people about why we should do things.
See, there you go. You just got a whole big hit of dopamine.
Yes, absolutely.
See, I've got it. I've put it all together. I got the concept and now I know how to approach it.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle. This has been fantastic. For those of you listening, what we'll do is we'll place Michelle's information below the podcast recording. You can go to her website. You can read the Rewired Conversation white paper that I had a look at and look at some of the other resources that Michelle's got. And if you have any further questions for Michelle about what we've been talking about today, please don't hesitate to get in touch with her. I found it just fascinating talking to you today, Michelle. I've got a bit of homework now that I need to go away and do. So I'm so thankful you were able to sit with us and take the time to give us all of this amazing information.
You are most welcome. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Thanks so much for listening to PWL's podcast, where I've spoken with Michelle Locke. Don't forget to check the links below so that you can access Michelle's white paper on powerful conversations. I know that you'll find that very interesting. Now, if you like what you've just heard, we're hoping that you'll actually tell other professional women in your network about us. We've grown organically and we're loving that fact. They can find more information about Professional Women's Lunches at www.professionalwomenslunches.com. No punctuation. Be sure to check out our other podcasts and also join us at one of our upcoming networking events. If you have any recommendations for subjects or perhaps you've got some people that you'd love to hear from, contact me, Kirsten Gunness, at kirsten@professionalwomenslunches.com. This has been a podcast mixed by Jose Perez for Professional Women's Lunches. We look forward to having you join us again soon.